You're listening to The Real Short Box, a comic book podcast made for geeks by geeks.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for coming out and listening to The Real Short Box. My name is Donald, and with me over here somewhere in podcast land is my friend with a capital D. His name is...
Darren,
and over here in my other dreamland, I suppose, would be the gentleman with a capital K.
That's Dr. Kevin.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, Dr. K, yes.
Hey, where is your degree from, by the way, Dr. Kevin?
Various universities, various.
Name one.
University of, what was it? It was Colorado Star Boulder? Or something like that, and the initials was BS, right?
No. One is from the Temple of the Jedi.
Yeah, more like the Temple of Comics, buddy. That's where your degree is. Anyway, speaking of comic books, we're here to discuss a very prolific, a very set in his ways creator. We're here to talk about one Alan Moore. How about
that?
Yes, a man who is definitely an original. He thinks for himself and he does as he pleases.
Absolutely. He definitely does as he pleases. I will say that. Very interesting guy to talk about. So let's get let's just dive right in. Alan Moore, he grew up in relative poverty in Northampton, England. So he was a very poor son of a mother and father. His father, I believe, was a brewer, and his mother, she was a printer.
Yes.
He also lived with his grandmother, and she was pretty religious and superstitious and stuff. So I think Moore credits her a lot for his ideals towards fantasy and wanting to be in that world so much. Interestingly enough, his grandfather used to use, he would go to the pub and he would swap caricatures. So he'd be like, I'll do a drawing of you if you buy me a beer, you know? And apparently he was a pretty hardcore drunk. So that, you know, kind of made sense in a way, why that would be the way it was. So that's kind of his early. He then basically graduated or placed out of the school that he was in his town, and he went to a much more middle class neighborhood school. And he noticed immediately that how he had excelled in his earlier career in school, he was now floundering. He just wasn't doing nearly as well as he would have liked to have done. And it made him uninterested in his schooling. He did not want to go to school anymore. And it kind of made him rebel a little bit against the structure of the classroom and structure in general, which is, I think, where we get a little bit of that anarchist that he will become in the future, just kind of starting to form there.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I found really interesting about Alan's early career, I mean, you want to talk about someone who definitely rejected academics. You know, Alan Moore, right before he started working, you know, in becoming a great writer, he was actually expelled from school for dealing LSD.
Oh my God.
Angel dust.
Yeah. And honestly, it's where they said what really ultimately got him caught was he was actually using his own product that he was selling. He was getting high off his own supply.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's something you're not supposed to do.
That's right. You're not supposed to do that.
Particularly in school. I don't know. I could be wrong, but that seems like a bad idea. So
yeah. LSD is a little hardcore.
busted out of school, busted just, you know, he had a little bit of an uptick. He met his first wife, and Phyllis, and they got married in, 1971, I believe. They had two daughters, Leah and Amber. And before Amber was born, Moore was working on the V for Vendetta. So he started working on that very early. And he eventually did marry, he did marry Phyllis, but he eventually then her and him decided to become what you would call polyamorous.
Mm-hmm.
And polyamory it basically means that you can have more than one lover. So
consensually.
Yes. So basically they brought in another woman into their relationship, and it worked out so well for Phyllis that she eventually left Alan and set up a home together with the other woman. And so Alan had introduced his wife to this other lady because of their polyamorous lifestyle, and then his wife ended up leaving him for said woman. So I thought that was rather comical in nature, so to speak, and a little sad too as well. But, you know, I guess what do you expect or what can you expect in those types of situations? You just don't know.
I'm going to avoid that one with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't blame you there. There's also something else strange. Besides his ideals and stuff of anarchy, which we often saw, like, for example, in V for Vendetta.
Yes.
He also had something very strange about him in his life. And, Kevin, you want to go over a little bit about that, since you're such a big fan of Serpentor and, you know, Cobra Commander?
Oh, yes, yes. You must be referring to his religious beliefs.
Yep.
He decided to become a ceremonial magician. He took up some of the black magic arts, and he was inspired by that from when he was writing from hell. Because the character he wrote says something to the effect of, the one place God inarguably exists is in the human mind. And he felt that, you know what, I feel that's a true statement. And he decided to rearrange his life around that. And so he felt, you know what, let me become a magician, because he felt that magic was similar to art. You know, it's like a symbol for many things. You know, it's like the science of manipulating symbols, words, and images. So he feels that, you know, art and magic are essentially, they go together hand in hand. So he decided to basically study the Kabbalah. He studied a 19th century, early 20th century occultist named Aleister Crowley, who I'm sure Darren's familiar with.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. We'll leave him for another topic another day.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and he did, what was it, an ancient cult snake god and glove puppet?
Lycon.
Lycon.
Yes, Lycon.
Alexander of, what is it? It looks like it says obnoxious, but it's...
Abanotatius?
Yeah, something like that in the mid-second century. So very... Mm-hmm. Very weird. His thoughts on religion, though, are kind of cheerful and reasonable. If you listen to him speak, which is interesting, because under that is his first philosophy was to do no harm. So
right.
He was Google before there was Google.
And what's interesting is he feels that monotheism is like similar to just being one ball of the alphabet, where he feels paganism and polytheism is like the whole alphabet. You know, you're looking at different points of view, so to speak, different shades, different nuances within, go ahead.
Well, his grandmother was Catholic, and apparently, from everything that I've researched, she was basically his inspiration. It seemed as though he had a better relationship with her than he did even with his own parents. So I guess that wouldn't be too surprising to me that he would have some interesting religious perspectives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because, Moore, even as a so-called magician, his thoughts were, interesting. He said, everything everyone says about magic is true. As long as you understand, it's all in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like everything's open to interpretation. So that's something that I think is good and bad in religion, because oftentimes people's interpretations of the Bible is what can get them into trouble or steer them towards a line of positivity. It just depends on what you're looking at and how you're interpreting it. So you know, you take it worth a grain of salt, actually, you know, when you're thinking about that. But
he does have a cool beard, by the way.
Well, yeah, it's interesting to see how this kind of philosophy influences his works.
Right.
Which we're kind of really digging in a little deep into that.
Right. With
you
V
know
for
what?
Vendetta, we all kind of are familiar with V for Vendetta. Remember the, what was it, the 5th of December or November?
November.
Yeah. My buddy Pete does the, well, our buddy Pete does the best at reciting that line. He does it pretty much every year, posts pictures and stuff, because he's a big fan of the movie. And the ideals and stuff behind it. And that, I believe it was McTeague that directed that.
Yeah, right. John McTeague directed it.
Yeah, and James McTeague. And I think that came out when we were all working at ArcLight, if I recall.
Yep, 2005. Yep, 15 years ago.
You know, it's interesting. When I first saw that movie, I just kind of like took the attitude of, I saw that movie. And I revisited it years later, and it's actually tremendous work, which is... As we'll probably get into here, Alan Moore doesn't really like the way people interpret and do his work. But I think V for Vendetta is an excellent film, and it's a timely movie. And I personally think that it's going to remain a classic.
And it was played by Agent Smith, Hugo Weaving.
Yeah. Yeah, it was played by Hugo Weaving, interestingly enough. And then after V for Vendetta, he was hired on to work in an American comic book, in American comics in general, which included titles such as Swamp Thing and Watchmen. Speaking of Swamp Thing, though, I think that's the big one everybody thinks about when they think about Alan Moore. Besides Watchmen, you know, V for Vendetta, the big one is Swamp Thing. And Darren, I think you have a little bit on that you wanted to speak to.
Well, what's interesting is... We have a very intelligent audience, so I do not want to insult their intelligence in any way. In terms of the power rankings here, I am definitely third in my knowledge of Swamp Thing. So I have a lot to live up to when we're talking about Donald and Kevin here. What I will say, though, about Swamp Thing, and these are the main points. So essentially, he was working – Alan Moore, before he fell into Swamp Thing, his early work, he was like a cartoonist. And he was doing, you know, various like pseudo, you know, comic adaptations and stuff. He was working mainly for a company, 2000 AD. And what's kind of interesting is that he had multiple pseudonyms, which are kind of funny. He was also known as Kurt Vile, Jill DeRay, and Translucia Baboon.
I like that one.
Yes. Publications including Doctor Who Weekly, 2000 AD, like we said. But what's interesting is those actually put him on to Swamp Thing. Now, at the time, Swamp Thing was a failure, a massive failure. DC, and this is unheard of, guys, in this time period of 1983, 84-ish, I believe. This is unheard of. They were actually going to cancel that character from DC Comics. Like, he was literally going to be gone. So Alan Moore was basically, you know, to quote the movie Blade, he was ice skating uphill here. And one of the things that he did, which what I think is the biggest contribution and the biggest change he made to Swamp Thing, instead of making him a human that transformed into a monster, he changed his origin to being a monster. Now, this is a really, really big deal, because you have to picture, like, if you're transformed into this kind of, you know, thing as a human, you're still going to have some kind of human in you. But if you're a monster from day one, you're just your way and your views and of life and your actual physical powers are completely different. And I was really like blown away by that when you think about it. And a lot of folks will consider this his best work. You know, like, I mean, the intellectuals spend way too much time, you know, talking about what the best stuff is Alan Moore did. But, you know, it's he went immediately out to creating this villain group. It's called the Sunderland Corporation. And the Sunderland Corporation was your standard evil corporation of the early 80s kind of thing. But the idea behind them was to take his research, you know, basically, you know, so, I mean, it's just a very different thing. And also, too, like, if you remember in the old Swamp Thing, you know, you would get these ridiculous supervillains like the Floronic Man, you know, no offense, he's not the worst, but I just wasn't really into that. Like, it just, the realism of this comic book was just amped up tremendously. And then you throw in the fact that Alan Moore has a very crazy imagination, you know, and I say that with respect, but he's a right. crazy imagination, and throwing this into a DC comic, because it would make perfect sense to me. You have a character that's a popular, famous character that is clearly on the decline, and Alan Moore is just coming in and saying, you know what? This guy's on life support anyway. I'm going to just come in and do my thing.
Right. Yeah, I think it's interesting because Alan Moore, he really, you're right, he didn't have anything to lose with this character. He was like, well, you know, if it's going to get canceled anyway, I might as well roll with it. But it actually started to really take off under him, and people started to really become involved in the character. And they're like, did you see what Alan Moore's doing over here with this character Swamp Thing? The fact that he took what we had believed since... Oh, when was that? It was, Jesus, that was since 1972, I believe, when Swamp Thing number one came out. Alec Holland had always been tied to Swamp Thing ever since 72. So what Alan did is he said, okay, yes, that's true. Swamp Thing and Alec Holland. What are you, unwrapping something? Good Lord. Alec Holland and Swamp Thing were together. They were one unit. But what Alan said about Alec Holland is that Swamp Thing actually was nature, and it took on the ideal, the persona of Alec Holland. Mm. So it really wasn't Alec Holland's body that was there. It was just his thoughts, his mind. So technically,
his personality.
Right. So technically it wasn't Alec at all. It was Swamp Thing. And he used Alec as that base to create a humanistic like character of Swamp Thing. And I found that very fascinating. Also a little, as an Alec Holland fan, a little disappointing, but, you know, very fascinating, because I didn't go back, and I'm going to be honest, I didn't read any of Alan Moore's Swamp Thing until the 2000s.
Wow.
So it was in the early 2000s when I got into that work and started reading it. And I thought it was very intriguing. And the fact that what's the character, the villain, the Floridic Man? The fact that character realized that he could possibly take over the role as the avatar of the green of the earth by eliminating Alec, you know, or eliminating Swamp Thing, was very fascinating to me. And in fact, it's something that's resonated through the title Swamp Thing to this day. I mean, that's discussed of him possibly losing his role within the green. And that's something that we can never have happen. It would be like, you know, finding, if everyone found out for sure that there was no God, you know, it's that would be just as catastrophic, losing Alec as the avatar of the green. It would be devastating to the green, getting somebody in there that could be of a vengeful spirit. So well, it's interesting.
Well, we're on a limited time clock here, so I just want to make one last point, and then I think we can move on. The Saga of Swamp Thing was the first mainstream comic book series to completely abandon the Comic Code Authority. And this, of course, came after the CCA denied the number 29 issue the seal of approval. On DC, they created an imprint to publish a series under no longer submitted issues of the Saga of Swamp Thing. So that, of course, is a massive historical thing that I think is very worth mentioning.
It went over to what? Vertigo, right? Is where it went over to, the imprint Vertigo.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so we're going to move past then Swamp Thing. We're going to move, what's the next thing there, Kevin? I think you've got some information on Watchmen, correct?
Yes, Watchmen is probably, to many people, considered one of the greatest comic book stories ever written. And what's interesting, I didn't even know this until recently, that it was among Time Magazine's 100 best novels from 1923 to the present, ever since the magazine had started. So it has that kind impact. This is where comic books began to be taken, you know, as a more serious literary art form. And it also won a Hugo Award, which is also crazy because they actually create a category just so they can give it an award. How crazy is that? It's almost like a special Oscar for when you invent something, some new technology.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how highly regarded this book is. And one of the reasons why this book is so regarded, like the series is so regarded, is because of how the superheroes were portrayed. They were kind of portrayed more realistically. You know, they're portrayed as real life people with real life flaws, with psychological issues, things that are very realistic scenarios involving, crime, sex, violence, and of course the politics. You know, they fictionally, you know, you have Richard Nixon serving like his fifth term, you know, due to things that happened, you know, in the past, or at least in this particular fictional story, which in World War II up until the 1980s. And the story was written because obviously Alan Moore, being an anarchist, was not a fan of the prime minister at that time, Margaret Thatcher. And he felt that she was had fascistic tendencies. So he kind of related to an American, you know, involving like a former President Nixon also having believing to him having fascistic tendencies. So he kind of wanted to make it relatable to the American audience.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that we have to have a podcast on in the future, just describing and discussing Watchmen and all its aspects, from the book, just culture impact, to the movie, which, by the way, you and I, we enjoyed it. It's not a perfect film, but, you know, it's not as bad as some people make it out to be. Yeah, but that'll be a story for another day.
I'll weigh in on that too. I think that's correct. I really was captivated by the first hour and a half of Watchmen myself. It just didn't hold me the way I would like it to. And I rewatched it, to be fair to it, because the first time around, it's definitely a lot to absorb. But I think it's also important to absorb the reason it's difficult to make things like Watchmen into a film is because you have to build a universe that's very foreign to an audience. I mean, you're talking about like lots of groundwork you'd have to make here. And I don't love the HBO series, but the HBO series at least had time to make a better effort at doing that.
Yeah, I agree. The movie, though, I loved personally. I think that movie's probably one of my favorite superhero movies of all time. I find it to be phenomenally well done. I think it's probably Zack Snyder's best work as far as like what he was able to do. They said that could never be done. Years and years and years of them trying to produce this and create a movie out of this story, and they said it could never be done. He made it. And it worked, and it might not have all the same elements that the book did.
Especially the ending, that a lot of people were pissed off about. Yeah.
But I feel that was the smarter choice, because I always thought the squid was kind of a dumb thing in the book. I never really took to that. I was like, well, that's stupid. Even as a kid, when I was, you know, in my early teens reading it, I was like, that doesn't make any sense to me. But the funny part is then what the HBO series does is it takes that idea and it kind of turns it in a way and makes it to where it almost becomes the hero in and of itself. The little squids and the giant squid and everything, and then just the thought of that coming back and everything that they're able to do with it. So the HBO series is a very slow burn. I must say that if you're into action, this is not an action superhero series. It's not Boys. The Boys is a great series for a particular reason, because it's action-packed, it's fun, it's balls to the wall. Watchmen is more methodical, more thought out as far as the intent and what it wants to drive home to the viewer. And I think that's where it thrives.
It's more thematic. It's like trying to drive certain themes.
Yeah, and it takes a while to do it. But I think the themes are important, and I think the series is important for that reason.
I see.
But I also feel like Watchmen, instead of people like really scrutinizing it and trying to figure out every inch of what it is and what it's trying to do, I think to some degree we have to also accept the fact that Watchmen is also a piece of art. you it's not just there, like it's not heavy-handed with its themes, in my view. I think it's just, it lives in its own world. And we have to respect that. It lives in its own world. And not everything about it has to be conventional. It's actually maybe the most unconventional graphic novel you will ever read. But naturally, I have to relentlessly mock it, the film, for having the Leonard Cohen Alleluia love scene.
Oh, well, that's fair. The other thing I can think of when we're talking about missteps is The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, not the book, which is excellent, by the way, and through DC Comics and their subsidiary, what was it called, ABC Comics, I believe, at the time.
Right. Are you talking about the movie that forced Sean Connery to retire?
Yeah, pretty much. It was so bad that Sean Connery said, "I give up." I went back and saw it. It's still not a great film by any means. It's better than what I gave it credit for, but it's still not good. You know, it's a fun popcorn flick to forget about, but not something you need to absolutely remember and want to revisit often.
I was just going to say, I feel like it's a very, I think it's a movie that really undervalued its source material. They could have done so much more with it, but instead they decided to dumb it down, and I found it entertaining, but there's just nothing that memorable about it. So I'll give you that one.
Right. Yeah, I agree. The other things that he's done some other stuff within the world of like Top 10, I believe was the name of the comic he was working on at the time through ABC. What was the other guy? It was an adventurer. Do you remember the name of that character?
Well, he partially did create John Constantine.
Right. That's true. He did create John Constantine, but I'm thinking a little bit later, part of the ABC line. And he's recently been brought back into the DC universe. It's one of the characters. He's an adventurer and I cannot remember his name. So
is it guys, Tom Strong's Terrific
Tales? That's it. Thank you. Tom Strong. Yes. So Tom Strong was an interesting book. One of my favorite recent ones that he did was called Smacks. And I think Smacks came from the Top 10 stories. And this was all about him adventuring and trying to kind of find himself along the way. And it was in a fairy tale realm. And the story was light and fun. And the artwork was actually quite amazing because there were so many things going on in the background. We're not talking about a Rob Liefeld piece of art here where there's like a simple white background and the guy's running and there's like action lines. This isn't an anime story in that aspect. This was a fleshed out, really detailed, created piece of work that I think if you're going to read it, you should enjoy it for what it is, definitely. But if you do decide that, you know, you're a little tired or something, you can also have one of Alan Moore's energy drinks that he created back in 2014. Drinks were called Fuel Rods, were sold in long, thin, bright green cans. He also released a new video game around the time called Escapism. The video game was reportedly slammed in the British press. Many found it odd that Moore, who was fiercely against any video game adaptations of his work, including Watchmen, agreed to have anything to do with his writing his own video game. So he was kind of seen as going back on his word, so to speak, and a lot of people didn't like that. But he's still writing. He's still out there. We definitely want you to take a look at his works and what he has to offer. There's a lot more than what we went over. This is just a quick gloss over.
Lost Girls.
Yeah, I know a little bit of them. But with that, I think we're going to wrap this up. Please seek us out on social media. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We are on Twitter. You can always engage with us. You can email us, message us through any of those. Kevin, do you want to name some of the podcasts that we're on right now?
Let's see, Spreaker, iTunes, Google Play. I can never say it right. Is it Blueberry?
It's Blurberry or Blueberry.
Blurberry. Thank you, Blurberry. That's right.
Yep. What was it? SoundCloud.
SoundCloud.
Jesus, and a host of others. Pretty much anything out there right now, we're into it and we're on it. So please seek us out. And if we don't hear from you on any of those or find that you're watching us, maybe we can talk to you about it sometime when we see you finally again.
at the luscious, luxurious, wonderful, sweet comic book shop.
This has been The Real Short Box. We'll see you at the comic shop. Thanks for listening.